Welcome to Off Hours, a conversation between John Edwards and Chris Manning.
Some follow-up from all the way back in episode 4 of Off Hours, when we were talking about various watchmaking schools around the world. There was an article that came across my feed the other day from Watches by SJX, and he was talking about Cambodia's first watchmaking school. It looks like they've found a patron to fund a new watchmaking school in Cambodia. And it looks like it's very, very well set up. And I don't remember how many students it says that it can handle at any time, but it looks like they can handle a good number of students, and that they'll be able to go through the full sort of WOSTEP style watchmaking program there. They intend to have a 2-year program. So I think the first class, it says, is opening up in June of 2020. So if you happen to be in an area where going to Cambodia for a couple of years to take a watchmaking course sounds good for you, you may want to look into applying for there. So it's nice to see new watchmaking schools popping up in different parts of the world that have not traditionally had them.
Mm-hmm. The school looks very well equipped, and it's fittingly named the Prince Horology School. It's quite a princely setup that they've got ready for these first students who will be attending in 2020.
Now, also from Watches by SJX, you pointed me towards an article that was quite fascinating. I haven't had a chance to finish reading it yet because it's quite in depth. But this is about commissioning a custom watch from Kari Voutilainen. What was this article about?
Yes, this is the most in-depth article I've seen written by a collector who has commissioned a piece from Voutilainen. Gary G wrote a really great article as well a couple years back for Quillen Pad about his experience commissioning a bespoke piece from Kari. But this one goes very in-depth and gives not only insight into the thought process that this particular collector has gone through in his ideologies in commissioning the piece, but also offers quite a bit of insight into Kari's mindset and thinking behind a watch and the way that he interacts with a client who is commissioning a piece. But it also delves into a lot of the technical details, both about the movement and the dial, and also about the many hands in addition to Kari's who are involved in the process and in making the watch, and the various artisans that's come alongside and help breathe life into these watches.
Yeah, I was impressed with the level of detail that he was able to gather as part of this process. And you can see just the sheer number of options that are available from a custom maker like Kari, especially when it comes to dial iterations. The variance that you can have when it comes to dial iterations, not just different engine turning designs, but also the various plating options that are available, the various layout options that are available, whether you're doing what type of numbers, applied numerals you're doing. It's incredible seeing all of this available to us, so that we can see just what sorts of things are available to a collector who's willing to spend the money and the time to get something like this commissioned. So it's quite impressive to see this all detailed. The photographs are great. I was really impressed with the level of detail that's available to us here.
And one of the insights I found both interesting and surprising from the article as well is that Kari doesn't present all these options right out of the gate to a client. He spends quite a bit of time in conversation with the client and trying to suss out what it is that the client desires, and does not overwhelm them with myriad choices, and just tends to guide the process along in a much more discreet manner. And at one point in the article, the author expresses a bit of frustration about not having been presented every possible option in certain matters pertaining to the dial. But he was also quick to point out the paradox of choice, that you can sort of freeze like a deer in the headlights if you're given too many options at the outset. So I think the way that Kari approaches things is wise, and is likely some hard-won wisdom there in having designed a number of bespoke pieces for various collectors over the years.
It's been a number of years since I've done custom work for people, and one of the reasons I've avoided doing it is because it is a real hassle to do this kind of work. Like it really takes a significant amount of time as the artist doing the work, and I think it really helps to have somebody who's managing that process be a different person than the person who's actually doing the work. The fact that Kari is not presenting the collector with every possible option is a great way of keeping your sanity, based on my experience doing this. You can't present a client with every single possible option. They just get overwhelmed with choice. And sometimes they also end up making decisions which don't really match with what it is that you're doing. And so you have to be careful about presenting things that are going to work well together so that the design options they have don't sort of interfere with each other. So, you know, you don't want to present somebody with the option to do, you know, let's say put two different colors together, which are going to look absolutely hideous. Or they want to put a particular design on a dial, which isn't going to work with the movement, let's say. So I think it makes a lot of sense to be very, very focused on what it is that you're giving somebody access to.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the amount of time it can take to pull off a custom piece like this as well. And I knew that some of these watches did take a substantial amount of time. And I can't say I was surprised so much by the amount of time, but I was surprised somewhat that the collector here was as open as he was about sharing it. But it took 27 months from the time that he placed the initial down payment on the piece until the time that he actually collected it. So it's like just a little over 2 years of a back and forth process to essentially bring this watch to life. And I know there are people out there complaining about trying to get industrialized watches from particular brands in a reasonable time frame, but it really shows an incredible amount of patience and discipline on the part of a collector to be willing to wait that long to finally have the piece delivered.
Yeah, if you're interested in getting any kind of custom work done, you have to expect it to take a good length of time to do it, and especially something like this that's as complicated as a watch. There's no way that you can knock that out in a few months, right? So I'm sure that I don't remember if he mentions how long it took for the design process to finish, but that alone can take months and months and months. And sometimes it goes nowhere, right? I remember spending probably the better part of 4.5 months going back and forth with the client, and we just could not agree on a design. And that was it. That it went nowhere from there. So that's one of the reasons why I've avoided doing this sort of work in the past. Currently, because it's just so frustrating, the amount of time and energy that's spent trying to get to a point where everybody agrees, and then it can be all for naught. So I'm impressed with, as you say, with the patience of the collector, and I'm impressed that Kari is able to do this. I know in the case of the Gary G article, I think there were 5 or 6 of them that ordered the watches, so they were. It wasn't just a one-off watch like this one was. There were a number of collectors who were getting that watch, so that makes things a little bit easier in some respect, because you know you can make multiples of something, and there's probably a little bit less freedom in terms of the design. Kari, I'm sure, probably put his foot down and said, "No, this is what we're doing for this design," or "Here are your two options for this," and that makes things go a little bit faster.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense there when you've got that many people all trying to get their own say on an otherwise very similar design between the lot of them.
The other thing that I found is that a lot of people don't appreciate the cost that's involved in doing a one-off piece and something that's completely unique to them. And so a lot of people, they're shocked when they hear how expensive it might be to do, let's say, a pen that's completely custom for them and has no, you know, no sort of foundation in other things that I've done. And that's something you have to realize, is that if somebody needs to design something from scratch, that's a lot of time and effort that you have to put into a piece that they may never be able to use again somewhere else. And that's just not something that that a lot of people can afford to do. So obviously, Kari's always doing very limited runs of stuff. And I expect that everything that he's doing here can probably be reused in something else, because the amount of time and effort to develop something from scratch is astronomical.
You're essentially throwing all economies of scale out the window.
Yeah.
And with this particular piece too, it actually adds a complication to the piece that has not been featured in a piece by Voutilainen before. So the collector actually worked with one of the constructeurs at Voutilainen's atelier, and essentially their role and job is to design a watch mechanism, or to make modifications to a watch's mechanism. And in this case, the collector worked with Guillaume Maya to add an additional indicator to the watch that would display the city for various time zones on the watch as well, and so as to respect the balance of the dial and not to clutter it up too much. This particular display was shifted to the back of the watch, and quite a number of modifications were needed to be made to the base movement in order to accommodate that, and to also make it feasible to adjust that time zone very quickly based on the city.
I've been seeing a lot of people lately putting complications on the back side of the dial like this. A few that I've seen recently are power reserves and sticking them on the back. As you say here, putting the sort of the GMT subdial, if you will, on the back. And I like this trend of seeing this. I don't know if we're ever going to see it in a lot of mainstream watches. I mean, obviously something like a Reverso, we've been seeing that for quite a while, but that's designed to be flipped over and you can sort of decide which face it is that you're going to see. But yeah, there's a lot more of this going on, and I like this trend. I think it's a good way of adding value and adding new features to a watch without making the dial into something that is a disaster in terms of legibility and layout and things like that. Because it's something we've talked about a few times in the past, is the challenges of having an extremely complicated dial that's full of too much stuff. And this is a nice balance of having the features that you want regularly on the dial, but then also having access to that complication if you need it just by taking the watch off and flipping it over. So I think it's a nice balance of what they've done here, and I hope we start seeing more people thinking about putting complications like this on the back of the, or at least indicators of some kind on the back of the dial, or the back of the watch.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's nice that the city reference is really only needed when setting the watch.
Yeah.
When it comes to a manually wound watch like this as well, it's not very convenient to be winding it while on the wrist. So you're going to be taking this watch off from time to time anyway. So when taking it off to wind it or to change the time zone based on the city, it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to flip it over and then use the push button within the crown itself to quickly change the GMT. And then you still get the GMT display on the front of the watch itself, conveniently nested in the seconds subdial, and then you get the day-night indicator paired along with that. And the end result is quite handsome. It reminds me of the Masterpiece 7 that Kari Voutilainen made, which is one of his early decimal repeaters, and it remains among one of my favorite timepieces that he has ever produced. And I was impressed too, by the thought and care that this collector put into the details of the dial. It's not often that you hear about the design of a watch dial from the perspective of a collector. It's more often that you get to hear it from the perspective of a watchmaker or a watch designer. And so that was very refreshing for me as well, and neat to see that. And just weighing the trade-offs between, say, Arabic numbers versus Roman numerals, putting just a few numerals on the dial, or whether to have a full array of numbers around the dial, as well as the different colors and contrasts and which guilloche patterns to go with. There's one point in there where they were talking about doing the sunburst pattern for the guilloche in the center, and the collector had originally wanted to go with a 24 segment array to represent the 24 hours in a day, but Kari very adeptly and appropriately nudged him towards going with 12 segments, which is a much more fitting number. I think it would have been very busy to have had that broken up into 24 sections.
Yeah, doing 24 lobe engine pattern on that would have been much too busy in something that small. It works okay if you're working on something a little bit bigger. Maybe if you were making this into a desk clock or something like that, you could get away with a 24 lobe rosette for the engine turning pattern. But 12 is certainly more appropriate for this kind of work and this scale of work.
A few episodes back, we mentioned as well that the Watches TV had released a video tour inside Kari Voutilainen's atelier on their Patreon page, and that it would soon be released to the world on YouTube. And that has now come to pass. So this walkthrough of Kari Voutilainen's main atelier, where the actual watchmaking happens, as well as their dial workshop, has now been published. They didn't make it over to his case manufacturing facility, so that'll be something perhaps for a later date, but at least two-thirds of what goes into making a Kari Voutilainen timepiece is now there, and gives a very nice glimpse into that, the most in-depth that I've seen to date.
I was very pleasantly surprised by this video. One of my big complaints about Marc-André's videos is that they're usually not long enough. I want to see more detail. I want to see him get into more about what's going on. And I understand that he's making it for a YouTube audience who typically don't want to watch anything longer than sort of 7 or 8 minute videos. So this one was a pleasant surprise, because I think it's 17 or 18 minutes long. And they do go into a lot of depth in terms of what they're making, how they're making things. They're showing artists working, everything from the actual design of the movements on SolidWorks, and sort of talking a little bit about that process, as well as talking about the machining of the actual movements themselves, and then everything about the dial manufacturing, and talking about the engine turning experience, talking about the different finishing they can do. It was a very remarkable look into what's going on. There certainly aren't a lot of watchmakers who would open up their doors like that and allow that much information about what they're doing out into the world. So it was wonderful to see that. It was nice from a maker's point of view to be able to see some of those details, because there really are a lot of amazing details in there that you just don't see otherwise. And of course, Marc-André's videos are always very, very well shot, so that helps a lot as well. They're very professionally done, and that helps to display exactly what it is that you're seeing, and if you know what you're looking for, you can get a lot of good information out of these videos.
The guilloche work is right in your wheelhouse. What did you think of seeing Kari's guilloche setup?
Yeah, it was nice to see the setup, and the engines that they're using are interesting. They're clearly vintage engines that they've done some work on and that they've modified a little bit for their purposes. It was kind of funny seeing these really nice, expensive old engines with $7 IKEA LED lamps on them to light the piece. It was, and ironically, I've got a number of those sitting in my shop as well that I use for lighting my my work surfaces. So I guess whatever works, it's that's what you're looking for. So it was nice seeing that. I may have to go through and do a couple of screen grabs of some of the images they posted of the patterns that they were working on, because they've actually got on screen at one point some of the recipes that they use for their patterns. So I'm kind of curious to go through and analyze a few of those and see what they're doing. So I'm very impressed. We've talked about Kari's stuff before. I've always been impressed with his engine turning work, and they do an amazing job of the engine turning. And this just solidifies in my mind that they are certainly doing some of the best engine turning out there right now on a regular basis on watches. I know that companies like Breguet are probably doing significantly more in terms of numbers, but I don't think that their engine turning work is quite as good as what Kari's doing. I think he's experimenting with patterns that few people are doing. Some of the I don't remember what he calls them. There are some of the sort of warping patterns that they've got that they've designed are excellent and look great. So I'm a huge fan of their engine turning, and it was really nice to see the actual process of what they were doing and a little bit more of how they're doing it.
Another of the insights I found interesting from the aforementioned SJX article on the custom piece was that for the guilloche dial, this piece was, they say, bead blasted by hand. It doesn't specify mm-hmm. exactly how, but it does say not sandblasted. So I wonder if perhaps it's the old school way of actually having a watery solution of sand material, essentially a bead blasting medium, and then slowly pouring that over a dial. So you get a much gentler effect. And then following that, they anodize the dial to give it the sort of color that you would think of as being a sort of a classic Breguet watch that would have been bleached silver. And then on top of that, they then do a lacquer coating. Now, having spoken to you a number of times, both on air and off air, about your preferences for the final finish on guilloche work, I'm curious your thoughts on these processes.
Yeah, the bead blasting, there's a couple of different ways you can do it. Most people these days, they're using an air-powered bead blaster. Now you can get little pencil bead blasters that will shoot your glass beads at high velocity into the work, and that sort of speeds the process up and gets you a very consistent look. Traditionally, you can do this by using something like a funnel with a small sort of orifice at the bottom of the funnel to drop the beads onto the work from a height, and it's a more subtle way of doing it. I know I've seen a couple of videos of Recep doing this with some of his bead blasting. I think on one of the movement plates that I think I saw him doing it. So there certainly are ways of bead blasting without using compressed air, and there are some advantages to doing it. Really what you're getting is you're getting a lot more control over how you build up that texture. And certainly there's less need for equipment, which is nice as well. And controlling beads under high pressure air is annoying because they tend to bounce everywhere, and it's they make a bit of a mess if you're not using it in a blasting cabinet properly. Yeah, for me that doesn't sound particularly different than what most people are doing in a modern way. It's just they're using a sort of a hand way of doing it, sort of a slower and more controlled way of doing it. In terms of the coloring and things like that, I'm not a big fan of coloring engine turning or bleaching engine turning. I think there's a place for it, depending on the texture that you're trying to create. But I also think that you're destroying a lot of what makes engine turning interesting. And that's that nice bright finish that you're getting. Now, of course, you have to be careful in the case of a watch, because a bright finish can completely overpower what it is that you're doing, especially if you've got, let's say, a bright finish behind the numbers on your chapter ring. That makes it extremely difficult to read what it is that you're trying to read. So there's a time and a place for bright finishes. I think that engine turning is one of them that you can do. That the cuts are fairly shallow, so you can get away with leaving them bright finished, at least from my experience with the dials that I've been experimenting with. So I'm not gonna suggest that everybody has to stop bleaching their dials when the engine turn them. But I think that people are using bleaching as sort of a default in a way that I don't think is necessary, and I think more people should look outside of that sort of design sense when it comes to how they're prepping their engine turning surfaces. It is nice to see, though, some of the anodization that he's doing and some of the coloring that they're doing and getting engine turning on different colors without necessarily using something like enamel over top of it. That's fascinating to see. There's a chart, I think, that shows up in that SJX article, and you can see the different colors that they're able to get on the dials, whether it's through a plating process or various galvanic operations, depending on what the metal is underneath and whatnot. So it is nice seeing some color coming out of that without necessarily using enamel over top of it.
Now, how would you describe the difference between the cuts on a dial that is fresh from the Rose engine versus a dial that has gone through that bleaching process?
When you take a piece of metal off of the engine, whether it's a Rose engine or a straight line engine, you've got a very bright, polished cut that comes out of it. The idea behind engine turning like that is that you're getting reflections coming from multiple angles, and because of that, it catches the light in certain ways that when you combine it with the various patterns of the engine turning, you get interesting moiré effects that come out of that reflection. So a light will be reflected and diffracted in different ways depending on how the pattern is designed. And when you bleach it, what you're doing with the bleaching process is that you heat the metal up. In this case, it's typically silver that you're doing it on. And that brings oxides to the surface layer of the metal. You then stick the metal into a hot acid. We call it a pickle bath. It's a specific type of acid that we're using. And the oxide layer that's come to the surface of it is typically a sulfur oxide that's on there. And the acid will dissolve that sulfur oxide, and you'll be left with a fine silver layer that is sort of frosted. Imagine if you were to take something like the bead blasting we were talking about, or sandblasting or sandpaper or something like that, and you rub that over glass. Often that's used in windows to provide privacy, so you see that sort of frosted look over a piece of glass. This is the same kind of thing. You're creating a frosted texture on the surface of the metal. And so all of those nice, bright, polished cuts that you had, they've now been presented with that frosted layer. And you're never going to get that reflection back that you got out of the cut when it first came off of the engine. And so you're losing something there. You're not getting the same reflections. You're not getting the same moiré effects that you would get from a bright polished cut. And so that's sort of what you're losing with it. Now, again, it's a different design element. It's a different design choice. And it's not necessarily the wrong way of doing something. But there are very, very few people who are leaving the engine turning as a bright polish. And so we're not really seeing how that would look and the difference between it and the bleached look that everybody seems to be doing these days.
These days as in the last couple of centuries.
And I firmly blame Breguet for this, because Breguet is the one who sort of, championed engine turning on dials. Thank you. I'm glad that you did that. But he never had bright cuts on his dials, as far as I know. Certainly none of the pieces I've seen have had bright cuts on them. And he was doing this process. And of course, everybody had to copy him. So now, 350, 400 years later, whatever it is, it's a tradition and nobody wants to change. And so that's, it's sort of a, a blessing and a curse of with what he did.
So in a somewhat similar vein to the surface finishing, there was a point in the video towards the end, so we're skipping ahead quite a ways here, but there were talking about polishing the dials, and they just very briefly showed a machine from Festo, which is a machine I've not seen before, and I can't say I know a whole lot about, although I am familiar with some of Festo's tooling. But this particular one, he spoke about being able to apply a very nice bright polish to the lacquer finishes on the dials without bending or warping the dials in any way. So this was quite neat and an interesting insight into the dial making process as well.
Yeah, I looked a little. I've looked up a little bit about what's going on there, and I think I haven't been able to get a definitive answer in what it is that he's doing, but I think it's basically a lapping process that he's doing. And so you're lapping the dial in between two very, very flat plates with a very fine abrasive in between them. And lapping is often used in prepping metal surfaces that have to be dead flat and often at a very high polish. And depending on the lapping compound you use, you can get incredible surface finish out of it, or you can also leave it slightly frosted, depending on what it is that you're trying to do. So I think that's what's going on here, based on the explanation that he was giving, and a little bit that I know about sort of what you're doing to get those sorts of surface finishes.
Mm-hmm. Lapping is what I would have presumed here as well, but it was the ambiguity of his explanation of what was actually happening. Yeah. In the process within this machine, which is effectively a black box. I'm not positive that is necessarily what's taking place there. So that's something I'd certainly be curious to learn more about.
And the other reason I think it's lapping is because I got the impression from a few comments that he's also able to get a frosted finish on it, but a very, very consistent frosted finish. And that also leads me to believe that it's a lapping process.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of a high polish, he also gave a quick peek at polishing some pinions. And the setup of those machines is quite involved. But once you get them set up, it's just devilishly simple and effective and quick. Just how well these machines work at giving a nice flat black polish to the leaves on a pinion.
Yeah, that was one of the great setups that he had. I did like the sort of ragged break in the disc that allows it to sort of pick the next pinion leaf up as it was going, and it was obviously just something where somebody tore the disc to be able to get it to do that. So yeah, setup for things like that was really nice to see. Also, things like the setup for polishing their screw heads and things like that. All sorts of great little details like that, little tools that they have. Some of them they've clearly made themselves. Some of them are clearly adapted from traditional watchmaking tools. And those are the little details that I love seeing in a movie like this, a video like this. They're all those little details that nobody wants to talk about. Nobody would ever, you know, make a video about how this happens or how it works, because a lot of it's just that's the way that it's done in the industry. And so nobody really talks about it because that's, you know, you just do it in the normal way sort of thing. But it's nice seeing those little details, and I hope that people appreciate them, even if they're not necessarily getting into watchmaking, because there are a lot of great little details about how they build these machines to, and again, when I say machines, a lot of times they're just very simple little jigs and fixtures that allow them to quickly and easily do the things that they need to do, like black polishing a screw head or black polishing the pinion leaves on these watches. So yeah, great, great little details like that in here.
An important step before achieving that black polish is the heat treatment of the steel and the tempering process that follows that as well. I was both surprised and impressed by how primitive the setup was for the hardening of steel in the atelier. Very old school. And the fact that they are putting literally thousands of tiny steel components through this treatment and this process over the course of a year to make, you know, the 50 some odd watches that are coming out of his workshop each and every year was really a bit of a sight to behold.
I wasn't very surprised that that's what they were doing, because frankly, it's such an easy way to do it. And it's, you know, if you've got somebody who's experienced it, even though it's primitive, they are going to be able to do it well and reproduce the results easily. So I can understand from that point of view. And when you start getting into sort of in more industrial processes for doing heat processing, heat treating, it's kind of ridiculous to use them on tiny little things like screws, because frankly, the industrial processes are being designed to heat treat hundreds or thousands of pounds of steel at a time. And of course, even though they're producing, I think they said, what was it, 8,000 heat treated parts a year, that's still a trivial number of parts just in terms of volume because of how tiny they are. So I'm not, in a lot of ways, I'm not really surprised that it's as primitive as it is, because it works, and all of the industrial versions are just so ridiculous. I'm sure if you're Rolex, you can justify doing it, doing it in a more industrial way, but 8,000 pieces a year is still a relatively small number compared to what a company like Rolex is doing. So it was fun to see, though. It was nice to see what they were, this guy sitting there in a darkened room, just, you know, slowly heat treating a part one at a time on a piece of charcoal and then dumping it into some water and going on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. And most of these pieces would weigh less than a gram. So even in being generous and saying each one weighed a gram at 8,000 pieces, it'd be less than eight kilograms of steel in the course of a year.
Yeah. Which nobody would ever, you know, if you sent that off to a heat treater, they would lose most of the parts. And, and secondly, they, you know, it wouldn't be worth their time to do. So, it would be challenging. It's, you know what, it's challenging for custom knife makers to have somebody heat treat a single blade, and a single blade is going to have more metal in it than probably half of the parts that Kari's heat treating in a year.
Mm, but it remains a stark contrast to say their anodization setup.
Sure, their anodization or their CNC setup or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously Kari has invested in technology where it makes sense to invest in technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And that obviously, and we didn't get a chance to see their case manufacturing, but I'm sure if we went into their case manufacturing, you would see a lot of high-end CNC machines and various other tools for doing things like, you know, die-sink EDM and wire EDM and stuff like that. So I suspect we would see a lot of modern machining methods show up in the case making also. But if, you know what, if the best way of doing something is the primitive way, or look at engine turning, right? You still have a talented person standing or sitting behind an engine and slowly turning that piece around and going over those cuts multiple times. And that's just the best way of doing it. Even though we have CNC machines now and we have stamping processes, still the best way of doing it. So it's nice to see him investing in the technology where it makes sense, and then going with it, you know, going old school when that's what makes sense.
And that is a very apt way to describe it, because Kari really is focused on the best way to do things. And no matter what facet of the watch or the company he is working on or looking at or evaluating, he really does endeavor and strive for the best possible way for things to be done. And the end result speaks for itself. One area of the workshop I would have liked to see in action that did get missed in the watch's TV video segment was the actual forming of the hairsprings, because I know that is something that Kari does there in-house. He's renowned for using a Phillips overcoil with a Grossman inner curve. And they show you a finished balance complete there with the hairspring installed, but they don't actually show you the crafts people hard at work defining those curves. So that would have been something or would be something I'd love to see in a future video from Marc-André, or, you know, frankly, would love to go and visit Kari myself someday and just witness that firsthand, maybe even try my own hand at it.
I agree. That was one of the things I noticed as well that was left out. And I suspect it does not make particularly compelling video, which is why it was never filmed, or it was filmed and it hit the cutting room floor. I don't know that it would be a very exciting film to anybody other than you and me and a handful of other people around the world. So I can understand why it wasn't in there. But yeah, I would love to see that, because I'm really curious to see how they go about doing that and how they poise their balances. They're obviously using free sprung movements here, so it would be nice to see that process, see what they're doing, see how they're actually adjusting that, because they are making all of their own components.
Amongst the CNC equipment, Haas was well represented there. Mm-hmm. And Kari was actually featured by Haas on their website a couple of years back. So we'll be sure to link to that in the show notes. And another article we'll link to on the case making side of things is another article by Gary G to offer a little bit of insight and a peek into that third facet of Kari Voutilainen's operation, in addition to what was covered there by the Watches TV.
Now, in the vein of visits to shops, another series of videos on YouTube that have been excellent are coming from Dean DK in Sydney, Australia. He's a new watchmaker who has been going through the same distance learning course through the BHI that I have been. And as part of his learning process, he's going through and rebuilding a 6497 movement from scratch. So he's taking an existing one and copying it, basically, and making his own copy of the 6497. And while he was on holiday in the UK and Europe earlier in the year with his family, he was able to visit a few different shops in the area. So far he has published videos from visits that he made to Vianney Halter's workshop. There's a series of, I want to say, four or five different videos that he made there. So that was great. He basically spent an entire day at Vianney's shop and chatting with him. So that was really nice. He also has a number of videos from when he visited Heinrich at KHWCC Watchmaking School in Le Locle, Switzerland. That's a school that we've talked about before a number of times. And if you haven't subscribed to Heinrich's blog, he's got a great blog where he talks about the processes, the what the students are doing. And in fact, he asks the students to write about their experiences on a weekly basis of what it is they're learning and what they're doing. So Dean's videos are excellent. He's been publishing regularly. In fact, since he's got back from holiday, he's been posting a video a day basically for the last week or so. And so I highly recommend checking those out. Again, some great insight into what people are doing, some behind the scenes look at workshops that we wouldn't normally be able to see. So go and check those out.
And one of the neat insights I appreciated from Vianney Halter's workshop was seeing that he too will, for just quickly prototyping something, just stick a piece of steel or brass onto a sheet of acrylic and hold it down in the mill with that, and then just have at it, which is something I do from time to time, but it's, I appreciate knowing that Vianney also does this, just knowing the level that he is executing at on a number of the timepieces that he has created over the years. It was very reassuring to see that.
Yeah, the couple, Vianney's a quite the character, and it's I've seen a few interviews with him over the years, and this one doesn't disappoint. He's some great tips and tricks out of what he's doing, and some great insight into how he's making.
So the decade is coming to a close, and by hints of things on your Instagram account there, it looks like the time in your current studio and workspace is drawing to some form of close. What's going on there?
Yeah, the my current studio, otherwise known as our house, and is currently being vacated. I am moving my studio and shop equipment out of the house, much to Tamara's delight. She's getting her living room back, as well as, well, really two-thirds of the house that I've been consuming with shop space over the last, nearly a decade at this point. So I am I am moving into a new shop space. Rich Lowen, who we've talked about a number of times on this show, a good friend and collaborator on a number of things, he and I are moving into a shared workspace as of right now. We're currently doing some demolition and construction and various other things in there. So it's going to house Lowen Design, Rich's design studio, where he's going to be making art and basically whatever strikes his fancy. And I'm going to be working on my watches and pens. So that's where Silverhand Studio is going to be based out of. And we also have a few other neat little things up our sleeves that we're going to put in there too. Some of that's secret and we're not going to quite reveal yet. But we're going to have some fun with it. And it's nice to be moving into a space that I can expand into a little bit. We've got, I think, a total of about 8,300 square feet that we're moving into, which is absolutely palatial compared to the sort of 900 square feet that I'm currently taking in the house. So that's sort of what I'm spending all of my time and mental energy on these days is prepping this move and getting the new studio prepared for us to move into.
That's exciting times. It sounds like it's going to be very well worth it once everything is all set in place and ready to go.
Yeah, the work that's involved in getting us prepped and doing the move is always painful, but once it's up and running and we're able to get in there and work on a daily basis, we're both going to be very, very happy, and we're going to be able to get a lot more done than we have been able to so far. Also, one of our goals for this is to film a lot of what we're doing and publish that, so we're going to start seeing a lot more of that. I know that one of my themes for this year was organization, which I have completely thrown out the window at this point, because doing any kind of a move is absolute chaos. But once we move into the new shop, I'll have to focus a lot on that, because despite the fact that we've got significantly more space than we've got now between the two of us, we're going to need to build a lot of organization to make sure that everything sort of stays under control there. And then, again, one of the themes I've had over the last few years is trying to get more videos out and share more of what it is that I'm doing. So while that didn't go so well this year, this process that we're going through of moving into a new space, this is certainly going to be something that we can use as a sort of a platform to more easily share what it is that we're doing and get it out into the world.
And we had the foundation waterproofed on our house here this year, and dealing with the contractors and delays with that certainly threw a wrench into my plans for the year, and then things took far longer and dragged out much longer than I had originally hoped, and it set all sorts of things back. So I hope that the contractors you're currently dealing with getting this new space set up goes a whole lot more smoothly, and that both you and Rich are able to set off on a great footing for 2020.
Yeah, nothing ever goes as smoothly as you planned. And, so certain things are taking longer than I want them to take. I know the contractors are happy with the pace that they're doing work, but I'm not happy with how fast things are going, because, frankly, I want to get everything moved. I want to get it all into the new space. I don't know how I'm going to move all of the stuff that I've got. Moving thousands and thousands of pounds of cast iron is going to be a bit of a nightmare. But slowly but surely, it's getting over there, and it's still going to be another few months, I think, before we're all up and running and working comfortably again. I'd be surprised if it doesn't take until sort of the beginning of March before I'm in there every day making things and actually, sort of happy with the way that things are. But it's going to be a great space when it's done, and we're really looking forward to being able to share some of that with everybody. And we're currently filming the process. We're not publishing any of that yet, but once we're ready, we'll be publishing some of the process of what it's taken to get this space up and running and get moved into it.
So for anyone who is interested, where should they be tuning into on YouTube to get a taste of that once the first video drops?
Well, right now you can get little teases of what's going on Instagram, both myself, my Instagram feed, silver_hand, and Rich's feed on Instagram is lowen.design. So that's where we're posting sort of our little teases right now of what's going on. You can see some of the fun that we're having with our sign out front of the studio, as well as some of the progress shots of what's happening in the studio space itself. But in terms of the sort of the videos in the long term, the Low End Design YouTube channel, that's going to be where a lot of this content's posted. And then, of course, my channel inside the studio. I've only got a few videos up there right now, but that will start to be filled up with a lot more content of what it is that we're doing. So between the two of them, that's the best place to follow in the long term, but also in the short term, you can find us on Instagram and see what's going on there.
Thanks for listening to Off Hours. You can find detailed show notes at offhours.show. If you'd like to keep up to date with the show, follow us on Twitter at Off Hours. John can be found on Twitter at UnderTheLoop, and Chris can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Silver_Hand.